I'm sure he'd be more than happy to speak further about this later on. We're just kind of strapped for time, so we've had to allocate 20 minutes to each speaker. Next, we've got Andy Worthington, who's a historian and journalist based in London. He's just published the Guantanamo Files, the stories of the 774 detainees in America's illegal prison by Pluto Press. As the title indicates, it's the first book to tell the stories of all the male men held in Guantanamo. He'll be discussing how he was inspired to write the book, how he came up with the information and its significance.
Hello, everybody. Very glad to see so many people here on such an inhospitable evening. We are. This is International Human Rights Day, which is a good time to discuss issues of human rights as we're discussing. It's also, in terms of Guantanamo, just over a month to the sixth anniversary of the opening of the prison. It's the 11th of January 2008. This book that I've written is about the 774 detainees who've been held in Guantanamo. There are something just over 300 detainees still left in Guantanamo, 60%. Have been released. Most of those are now free. Some are held in the custody of their governments, but most of those people have ended up free. What unites both sets of these men, though, the ones who are still there and the ones who've been released, is that, with some exceptions, and Moaz Amir is one of the exceptions, and I'm sure that we know some of the stories about some of the other British detainees, and you've maybe heard stories about a few dozen others at most, I would suspect, is that the stories of so many of these people who have been imprisoned for such a long time, without charge, without trial, are unknown. It's part of what Mozan was talking about the dehumanization of these people. It's really making them into America's disappeared. And Mozan has spoken about what lies underneath, if you like, the tip of the iceberg, which is Guantanamo, of the people that are held in secret prisons, the people that are held in Iraq, where I think there are estimates that there are something like 15,000 people, nearly all Iraqis, held in prisons in Iraq by the Americans. And these people really are the disappeared at the moment. It's going to take a long time for their stories to come out. But where I was able to start was with the stories of the people in Guantanamo. And the way that this happened was that last spring. So after the prison had been open for over 4 years, and last spring it was still impossible to say with any certainty who was actually in Guantanamo. The Pentagon had never released the names or the nationalities or any information about the people who were in there. At the time that I began my research, I was fortunate that the Associated Press had filed a Freedom of Information request using that legislation in the United States to compel the United States government to release information about the men. And the Pentagon refused, and the Associated Press put a lot of money on the line, I think, but took them to court. They took the Defense Department of the United States to court, and they won. So the United States government was forced to release 8,000 pages of documents relating to the prisoners. It was the first time that a comprehensive list was published of the people who were there. It was the first time that transcripts were released of the tribunals that these men had been subjected to in Guantanamo, which in a lot of cases is still the only way that any of these men's stories have come out. Now, the tribunals arose, they started in the summer of 2004. So Guantanamo had been open for 2.5 years at that point. And what happened was that in June 2004, the slow grinding legal process whereby very brave lawyers and very brave and principled lawyers in the United States who'd been taking on the American government because they'd established a lawless prison and were demanding habeas corpus rights for these men, that whenever you're captured you have the right to question why you've been captured and to go before a judge who will decide your case. So this case had been rumbling on for 2.5 years while the men in Guantanamo at the time were completely cut off from the outside world. And the Supreme Court made a very significant decision that June and said these men do have the right to challenge the basis of their detention. These men are also held in a place called Guantanamo, which is not, as you're claiming, somewhere that the US doesn't have sovereignty of because it's part of Cuba. and because you've had this lease going on for 100 years. This is, in effect, US territory, and that's why they have the right to ask you why it is that they're being held. Now, the government's response to this was not to allow them into the US court system, as lawyers hoped. What did happen as a result of that was that the detainees were allowed access to lawyers, and I think Moazzam was one of the first detainees to meet a lawyer called Gita Gutierrez from the Center of Constitutional Rights in New York. But when it came to addressing the issue of the detainees being able to challenge the basis of their detention, this evidence that had been compiled against them, this evidence that the government refused to admit where it had come from, then instead of going before the US court system, they said, no, we're going to establish a tribunal system where we are going to allow the detainees to tell their stories and where we present the allegations to them. And we decide whether, when they were captured, we were right to designate them all as enemy combatants. Because that's what everybody was declared. When they were caught, they were effectively automatically all decided that they were guilty. Innocence didn't really come into the picture. So these tribunals were horribly skewed from a legal point of view. Because although the detainees were allowed to meet with legal representatives to discuss cases that might one day come before the US courts, in Guantanamo they weren't allowed any legal representation whatsoever in these tribunals. And secret evidence was withheld from them. But it did at least give them a voice. And when these tribunal transcripts were finally released, these were the documents that I went through to try and understand who is actually in Guantanamo. And so over a really long and quite arduous process of many months, I went through the names, I went through the transcripts, and I built up a chronology of who was there to establish, you know, who are these worst of the worst? Can I break these men down into groups of people who are captured in certain places? Will that tell me some more of the story? And that's exactly what I did, and that's exactly what happened. So that I ended up establishing that there were groups of men who were captured in Afghanistan. There were groups of men who were captured crossing from Afghanistan into Pakistan after the US-led invasion had begun. A huge group of people were captured in that period in a very short amount of time, a week at the most, mostly in the space of about 3 or 4 days, about 250 people. They were crossing to escape from Afghanistan, and they were a mixture of all kinds of people. There were Taliban foot soldiers who had been fighting in Afghanistan and had been fighting against the Northern Alliance in a long-standing inter-Muslim civil war. These were people who'd been there before 9/11. They weren't necessarily connected in any way with Al-Qaeda and knew nothing about 9/11. And in amongst all these people were people who had other reasons to be there, people who were humanitarian aid workers, people who were religious students or religious teachers, drifters, entrepreneurs, all kinds of people ended up trying to escape from Afghanistan after the war had broken out, and everybody was rounded up. The Americans were offering bounty payments of an average of $5,000 a head for Al-Qaeda and Taliban suspects. And this meant there was a price on the head, really, of any Arab who was in Afghanistan at the time. And this spread to Pakistan as well. There were at least 120 people in Guantanamo who were rounded up in Pakistan without ever having set foot in Afghanistan, which was where the war zone was supposed to be. And the same thing was happening in Pakistan, that bounties were being offered. And what makes it possibly even more confusing in terms of Pakistani politics is that because elements of the army and the intelligence services had actually been responsible for being involved in establishing the Taliban in the first place, is that some of the arrests in Pakistan basically involved the Pakistanis going, look, these are the dangerous guys, so we're going to keep them over here, and pointing out this lot, who are completely innocent, and handing them over to the Americans to keep them happy. And this is how, even more than with the people who were caught in Afghanistan, you end up with a whole load of people who were captured in Pakistan at various cities who had been working in Pakistan for years, decades in some cases. Immigrants from countries all over the Muslim world who had ended up in Pakistan working for charities, working in hospitals as administrators, working with orphans, working as teachers, just rounded up all over the place, just purely through opportunism, really. And this is the kind of main body of the people. As Moazzam has mentioned, there are the people who were subjected to extraordinary rendition. So these are the people who, even more contrary to the American claims that these are all people who were picked up on the battlefield, were actually picked up in 17 different countries around the world, which are extremely long way away from the battlefields of Afghanistan. And so having established this kind of chronology, this was what enabled me then to start to break down these stories and to come up with these really quite shocking statistics. And while clearly, given the situation that prevailed in Guantanamo and that still prevails to this day, which is that all we have are allegations and counter-allegations, this is not an adequate substitute for a proper legal system and for a properly constituted court. We may have problems with the legal system in various ways, but in general, the system that has been set up, whereby somebody is charged and then two sides argue and a jury makes a decision and a judge is there, works pretty well. It has a decent kind of success rate compared to what's been happening at Guantanamo, where, as I said at the beginning, 60% of the worst of the worst have been released. And of the men who are still there, let's call it 300. It's a little bit over that, but let's say 300. About 70 of these men have also been cleared for release. Ironically, the Americans can't release them because they come from countries where they're at risk of torture if they're returned to those places. The irony seems to be lost on the US administration that they haven't actually been staying in a 5-star hotel for the last few years. So that takes us down to about 230 people. Are they all the worst of the worst? Well, the latest that the US administration has said is that it wants to pursue these war crimes trials that Moazzam mentioned, the military commissions, against 80 of the men. So we're down to effectively 10% of the people who were ever held in Guantanamo in the first place. Legal experts that I've spoken to, anybody who's studied in any depth the stories of the Guantanamo detainees, doubts that it's plausible in any way that cases could be pursued against that many of the people who are held in Guantanamo. I think for some years now, whenever kind of senior CIA analysts and other intelligence experts have spoken about Guantanamo, they've suggested that maybe there are 36 people in there who are genuinely dangerous to the United States in any kind of way. And that leaves between these 70 who are cleared, who can't be returned home because they're from countries like China and they're from various northern African regimes the Americans don't want them returned to, and the 80 that they want to charge, leaves this group of 100 or so in the middle, where the Americans have consulted another law book that the rest of the world has never seen, and are prepared to put spokesmen out in public and declare that these people are too dangerous to be released, but not dangerous enough to be charged. I'm not a legal student. I studied English and history, but I know that that doesn't exist in any law book. And one of these people is Omar de Gaez, who is one of the British residents who we hear is going to be coming home soon. Omar, whose father was a lawyer and a trade union activist in Colonel Gaddafi's Libya, and was murdered by Colonel Gaddafi's regime. And his family all came to Britain in about 1984 and settled here. And Omar, by some kind of accident, really didn't get a passport, which is the only reason that he isn't already back, wasn't back years ago, along with Moazzam. But Omar, the evidence that the Americans claimed to have against him, and the evidence that to this day, even when if Omar does come home in a few weeks or however soon it is, that the Americans will still maintain that he's a dangerous man, is a video that they came across, which purported to show Omar this grainy video of him in a Chechen training camp. Now, it was established 2 years ago by his lawyers and by reporters from BBC's Newsnight and people who analysed closely the grainy image of this man, that it wasn't Omar at all. And yet that's the only piece of evidence. But Omar fitted into this category of too dangerous to be released, but not dangerous enough to be charged, which, you know, I mean, I can't even really cope with that. I think Mozam, while I'm talking about British prisoners, Mozam has mentioned Binyam Mohammed, who is one of the... What happened in summer, the British government, Gordon Brown's government, requested the return of five British residents from Guantanamo. And the announcement that was made at the weekend was that four of these have been approved for release. And Shakir Amer will be going to Saudi Arabia, and the other three men, including Omar De Gaia, will be coming back to Britain. And the one who's left there is Binyam Mohammed. It's very important for all of us not to let him now be forgotten, because Binyam has been through this colossally horrible torture, and there seems to be no evidence against him whatsoever that was not produced through torture. In other words, every single piece of evidence that identifies him as a would-be major Al-Qaeda operative has come through the torture either of himself or of other people. But there is one more man in Guantanamo who I would like us all to think about, and if you can at all get involved to campaign at any level to get Binyam, the last British resident, back, then you should be aware that there are actually two British residents. And the last man is Ahmed Belbakr, and Ahmed Belbakr was a professional footballer in Algeria. And when he gave up playing football, he took a job in an office for an Algerian oil company. And he was threatened by radical Islamists as a result, and fled to Britain. And he settled in Bournemouth. He took a job in a hotel. He was actually working at the hotel when the Labour Party conference was there in 1999. And he did such a good job that he got a letter of thanks and a tip from the Deputy Prime Minister at the time, John Prescott. Now, Ahmed, like many of the people who ended up in Guantanamo, decided to take a holiday in the wrong time at the wrong place and ended up in Guantanamo. Now, there were all kinds of spectral allegations that were conjured up against him of terrorism, which all faded away as the years passed. And he was cleared for release at the start of this year, but the British government wouldn't accept him back. When Ahmed went on holiday, unfortunately he went on holiday before his paperwork approving him to stay in this country had gone through. He'd actually been in Guantanamo for nearly a year when that paperwork went through approving him to stay. But because he wasn't actually in the country when that happened, then the British government has thrown up its hands and said, well, there's nothing to do with us and we don't want anything to do with him. Now, technically, that's correct, but it's remarkably mean-spirited that this man who has been cleared by the Americans and who was living here, that they don't want to act on his behalf. And what complicates it for Ahmed is that he really genuinely fears for his safety if he's returned to Algeria. Not only did he leave the country because militant groups were threatening his life in the first place, but the Algerian security services don't have a particularly great reputation and have already told his lawyers that they can't guarantee his safety. So he's squeezed from both sides, really. And he's somebody that we need to campaign for as well. So I shall stop there. Thank you very much for your time. Thank you.